from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In our first half hour coming up, we'll discuss the fight against ISIS in Iraq. Last week, Iraq military declared victory, reclaiming the city of Mosul from ISIS, and we'll talk about conditions in Mosul and what the victory means for the region. Then at 9:30, for the past few years, structure fires have plagued Oakland, most notably last year's ghost ship fire, which took 36 lives. And most recently, a massive structure fire at a construction site near Lake Merritt that displaced nearly 700 people. Now, an East Bay Times investigation has found that since 2011, Oakland has only followed up on 21% of the structures flagged by firefighters for inspection. It's all coming up on Forum after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A week after Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi declared victory in a grueling 9-month offensive to retake Mosul from ISIS, the city is still reeling. Nearly 900,000 people have been displaced, and the United Nations estimates are that it will cost more than $1 billion to repair basic infrastructure. The victory comes without a political agreement between Iraq's two largest communities, Sunni and Shiite Arabs. Joining us to discuss Iraq's fight against ISIS and the future of Mosul is Graham Wood, correspondent for The Atlantic and author of The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. Graham Wood, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Good to be here.
I guess the place to begin is, what kind of victory is this? It's being declared a victory. There was a holiday. There was a parade by the present Iraqi government. And as I mentioned, you've got 900,000 people who have been displaced. You've got thousands who have been killed. And you have no idea how many actually have been killed because many are buried under collapsed buildings. And I'm also thinking, when I ask you this question about what kind of victory this is, we're almost back to where we were in some ways. You've got a Shia sectarian victory, but back to where we were in some ways with Shias running the show, like it was before Daesh or ISIS took over.
There are a lot of people who look at the situation right now and say, what kind of victory is it if you have no city to rejoice in? It's a pile of rubble, especially on the western side of the river there. And it's in a way rewinding the clock to 2014, which is just 3 years ago. The idea that we would celebrate the liberation of Mosul in a kind of unmixed way, I think rubs a lot of people the wrong way. Plus, you know, the reports from the ground in Mosul usually point out that there's still fighting in the city. You know, the prime minister did go there. There is celebration. On the other hand, if you're walking around Western Mosul right now, you're taking your life into your own hands.
And there's still, all this cost for infrastructure. As I said, United Nations, actually the estimate was at $1.3 billion. And oil prices are lower, so there's a lack of cash. It's really going to be difficult to rebuild.
Yeah, I think we have to look at some of the fundamentals that allowed Mosul to be taken in the first place. You know, I was in Mosul in 2013. I believe I was the last American reporter to be there before ISIS came to town. And when you asked people what their relationship was to the central government, what kind of trust that they had in Baghdad, they would say none at all. So I think what we have to look at is the fundamental sense of belonging that Mosulis have to the Iraqi state. And that's going to be very, very low right now. They believed that ISIS, whatever its faults, and they recognized plenty of those faults at the time, it was a Sunni Arab organization and was going to be a champion of that sectarian identity. And I think it's clear that right now the Iraqi operation to liberate Mosul has been also perceived as a sectarian liberation. So it's still going to leave Mosul in a state where the population is unsure whether it can trust anyone who's coming in to quote-unquote liberate it.
And we should mention there have been reports of brutality against Mosul citizens by the largely Sunni Iraqi military. And ISIS success was due in part to initially abuses by Iraqi security forces. But I want to get to what your judgment is on the effect of the caliphate generally, as you see it, Graham Wood.
Yeah, so I think we do need to first note that there are ways in which the loss of Mosul for ISIS is a really big deal for them. You know, the whole claim of ISIS when it came to town, when it declared its caliphate there in Mosul, was that it was able to rule as a proper Muslim state, the only Islamic state in the world. And for it to lose territory, even if it is able to kill people in the streets, even if it is able to turn back into a guerrilla force, it's not able to do the main thing that it claimed that it was going to be able to do when it came to town. So it does matter a lot. But what it means for the caliphate more generally, though, is that it's going to revert to the extremely dangerous position that it was in early 2014 before it took Mosul. That is, it will have some strategic depth in Syria, in some parts of the border region with Iraq, and it will be plotting a return as it did then successfully and as it may be doing now, perhaps successfully in a couple of years.
There are still ISIS strongholds, aren't there, in Mosul? I mean, they still have to retake a good deal, and they have ISIS fighters still who are kind of blending in with civilians or the civilian population?
I don't think there's really an area of Mosul where ISIS that ISIS truly controls any longer. The old city had a pocket that was surrounded. It has been really pounded into the dust by now. And ISIS doesn't control it. But they do control still the city of Raqqa, their de facto capital in Syria, and what they call the Euphrates province, which is that border area, Al-Furat. And those areas, Raqqa is coming closer to being retaken, but Al-Furat has been the strategic depth, the stronghold of ISIS for a very long time, since before it was even called ISIS. And that's not anywhere close to being retaken.
But I am reading about ISIS fighters who haven't been captured or killed, who are still there, and their families, I'm reading, are vulnerable. Women and children are getting grenades tossed at them. There's talk about rehabilitating them and all that, but nevertheless, they're vulnerable.
Yeah, Mosul's an interesting case because we think of ISIS, especially as Americans, as being a terrorist group that's trying to lash out outside of its territory, trying to hit America, hit Europe. And in some parts of ISIS territory, like Raqqa, it really was an organization of foreigners who had come from Europe, come from Arab countries, and were trying to live an Islamic life and then in some cases go back to fight to their home countries. Mosul was never really like that. Mosul has been in an Iraqi city during the whole time that it's been part of ISIS. And so when the city's retaken, some of those fighters are going to be dead, and then some of them are going to melt away and perhaps not take up arms again. But we need to remember that the fighters, they have nowhere to go in many cases. They're already at home. And so we shouldn't expect them to simply disappear and fight elsewhere.
Once again, we're talking with Graham Wood, who is a correspondent for The Atlantic and author of The Way of Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. We're talking about Mosul, which Iraq took back from ISIS last week, and the fight against ISIS in the region. We do want to hear from you and welcome your questions or comments, and let me tell you how you can join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you right now. It's 866-733-6786, and join us whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite at that number. With questions or comments, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but we do indeed want to hear from you and hope that you will join us in the time we have left. We're going up to the half hour here, but what about, Graham Wood, I need to ask you about the role of U.S. airstrikes and really the United States in here. I mean, Iran is very involved, against ISIS, Revolutionary Guard particularly, but so is the United States.
Yeah, the United States air power has been very important in taking back territory. But Mosul is a pretty crowded city. So it's been block by block, street by street. And because of that, it's primarily been an Iraqi operation. Now, the United States has given what support it can. Airstrikes have been called in. I mentioned parts of the city being reduced to dust. And that's largely because of what's happened from overhead. That's the United States' role in this. But it's been I think much, much more costly, of course, to the Iraqis, and you can understand why they would want to own it as their operation, hence the celebration last week.
And let me bring our callers in. And again, you can join us, and we welcome your calls at 866-733-6786. Liam, first up, morning. You're on the air.
My question is, where would the money come for a rebuild of Mosul? And Would the U.S. military be involved? I know that in the Iraq War, they were involved in some, you know, projects that were assisting the surge and the troops. Mm-hmm. And then what are the strategic goals of the Iraqi central government, given the noted sectarian divides?
Grahamwood.
Yeah, so, Liam, I think the money question has almost not really been asked. It has been such a costly fight in terms of blood and life over the last 9 months that it hasn't really been a sure thing that Mosul was even going to be retaken on a schedule that would be politically feasible. So now that the city has been retaken, there has to be still a lot of assessment to figure out what happens next.
United Nations is putting up $700 million, though, isn't it?
There's money that's been pledged, but exactly how this is going to be rebuilt, both the infrastructure and then I think Leah mentioned as well the political aspects of this,
yeah.
What the plan is by the Iraqi central government. That's the much more difficult question, because if Mosul thinks of the Iraqi government as being a Shia sectarian force, then again, we're right back to where we were in 2014, except much worse, because the ISIS enemy at the gates that we had back then was one that was coming in from the desert, didn't have that much experience. And now that same enemy is waiting to retake Mosul and is waiting to exploit those sectarian impulses. And now it has the experience of running a state. It has an experience making propaganda, has the experience of military operations, big retaking cities, small, that is terror ops, raids, commando raids. It's a much more dangerous enemy than it was before. And the fact that the Iraqi government seems to have no credible way of portraying itself as a kind of inclusive government is a big problem. And I really don't see any path that they have toward resolving it.
What about resolving the humanitarian crisis? I mean, we need some solutions to that, and the United Nations senior officials have called from the United Nations for support both regionally and internationally, not only to stabilize security but to get the kind of help that Liam is asking about. What's your thoughts about? I mean, are you optimistic about that really we can do something about ameliorating this humanitarian crisis?
There's the short-term crisis and then the long-term one. And the longer the view that you take, the more the political side is important. In the short term, the good news is that the people who have moved out of Mosul as displaced people, IDPs, they have started moving back. Eastern Mosul is kind of up and running, and a lot of people will take into their own hands the reconstruction and rebuilding of the physical and social part of the city. But it's a long-term thing. And again, figuring out a government that's satisfactory then will be the hardest part.
Next caller, Frank, you're on. Good morning. Frank?
Good morning. Yeah. I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Question for Mr. Wood. Given the long history of Sunni-Shia animosity, and in particular, the fact that many of these people who became Daesh fought with the U.S. Awakening Crew and were promised weapons and integration into the army until al-Maliki decided to become a Shia state. Is there any way to erase that feeling of betrayal and distrust, particularly given that the army has just bombed their city into rubble, with the Americans' help, of course?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Frank. Graham Wood.
You know, a lot of the people who were fighting on the side of the United States in the awakening did not join ISIS, but in fact were assassinated by them. One of the first things that ISIS did, even before it took that territory, was to make lists. They would send people into villages, into towns, and then make lists of the people who had fought on the side of the United States and who might fight in a future awakening-style operation. That is where the United States went in, got bigwigs, and paid them off to fight against al-Qaeda. And once they made those lists, they conducted an assassination campaign that meant that when ISIS did come to the town as an invading force, there was no one there who could be raised up as an anti-ISIS fighting force. So I think it's not so much that people feel like they were betrayed by the United States as that those people don't exist anymore. ISIS was simply strategically and tactically too smart and too able to get rid of them, that right now they don't exist. They don't exist. They're not alive to feel betrayed. And instead, they're you'd hope that there were such people around, but they're simply gone.
And let me thank Frank for the call and remind you that we're talking to Graham Wood, correspondent for The Atlantic, author of The Way of Strangers, of the Strangers, Encounters with ISIS, and talking about Mosul. There's a sense that terrible things are still going on there. I mean, there are reports, for example, Graham, of small children being used as shields with explosives detonated when Iraqi soldiers go to help them. There are reports, as I said earlier, about grenades being launched by Sunni soldiers, by Iraqi soldiers, I should say, Shia soldiers, actually. You know, there may be a sense now that the Iraqis have once again taken over, taken back, but at the same time, there just seems to be so much violence going on underneath the radar.
Yeah, one of the saddest things that I've seen, and there are plenty of sad things to compete with it in this war, is the very credible images of war crimes being perpetrated in Mosul by Iraqi soldiers and people affiliated with the Iraqi military. I mean, it simply looked exactly like what ISIS was doing, except with Sunni victims rather than Shia. And that's simply – it's poisonous when it comes to coming up with an ultimate political solution to the Mosul problem. It is something that everybody sees. Everybody will remember the fact that when ISIS fighters were found, once they were disarmed, they were shot in the head rather than taken prisoner. It seems like simply quid pro quo, of course, for people who have been fighting a brutal war like this. But that will not be forgotten. It's just a continuation of that cycle.
And how many civilian deaths do you think have occurred because of the coalition airstrikes which involved the United States? I mean, I've seen estimates as low as, one death, bad enough, but civilians, but between like 450 and 4,500. We really don't know. In fact, I also am inclined to ask you about what kind of coverage is going on because reporters have been barred from the old city.
We've seen very little of that. I mean, there have been some very well-publicized airstrikes that have destroyed buildings with over 100, possibly as many as 200 civilians in and around them. So that right there puts the number at very high, morally problematic levels. So that's not good. How much of this is attributable to the United States or to coalition airstrikes? I mean, there is, of course, the fact that ISIS simply does not follow international norms of war. So it will happily blend in with the population in ways that if the United States did it or another Geneva Convention recognizing entity, it would be a war crime on our part. So, where do you place the blame? I think it's hard to say.
Is there much economic activity going on in Mosul? I mean, because there really aren't many roads left intact. There are huge potholes that make driving difficult for especially non-military vehicles.
In western Mosul, there is not much. So the old city, one of the reasons that the Iraqi army has been treating anyone they find in the old city as ISIS is because there's nothing going on there except for fighting. If you're there, then it's highly likely that you're simply a member of ISIS. That doesn't, of course, excuse killing a non-combatant once he throws down his weapons. But there's not much economic activity there. In eastern Mosul, it's a different thing. It hasn't been a completely destroyed city over there, and so there are restaurants open, there are businesses open, and that's a good sign. But once Western Mosul is still kind of a black box of fighting. We don't have many reporters who have been able to be there. Even the Iraqi military has actually stopped reporters from going in. So not much economic activity and possibly a lot of horrible things that are beyond the view of the world.
You know, you sort of feel almost helpless, especially here in the West, in terms of any kind of movement that would be possible toward a political solution. I'm just wondering, is there some ray of hope that can come through here? Is there somebody, maybe even like al-Abadi, who can step up and say, look, you know, we need what we've always needed. We need for Sunnis and Shia to somehow get along or talk to each other at least.
I think this is really demonstrating what 3 years does. 3 years of ISIS control of the second largest city in Iraq means that the sense of difference, the sense of irreconcilability between Sunni and Shia has only increased during that time. It's been so costly that it's taken this long for us to see the city retaken. So, I mean, it's going to take at least that long before there's any kind of sense of compromise or stitching the country back together. And if anything happens in those 3 years that resembles the actual operation to take back Mosul, that is, if it looks just as sectarian as that, then of course it's hopeless.
Well, I've got a question from a listener named James who wants to know what you think about the staff reductions of the State Department and where that might fit into all this.
Huh. That's an interesting point. I mean, the staff reductions in the State Department, I'm not an expert on. There was a period, of course, when the diplomatic efforts of the United States were what was holding Iraq together. That was the period when the United States actually had leverage in Iraq because we had a bunch of troops there and because we had a huge diplomatic presence. Now we just don't have that leverage anymore. And so staff reductions, of course, aren't going to help. But we just don't have the possibility of forcing the government of al-Abadi to the table and forcing them to be more sensible from our perspective.
Again, our guest is Graham Wood, correspondent for The Atlantic, author of The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with ISIS. Here is Greg as our next caller. Greg, you're on.
Morning. I just want to try to understand why the UN has never stepped in. We have, you know, millions of people being displaced, completely, you know, devastating, you know, all of these refugees going to different countries. And, I mean, this is what they're for. And Trump is calling for all this money to be pouring into the UN, and yet there's just nothing coming from them.
First of all, quick correction, Greg. I wouldn't say millions. The estimates are probably a little less than a million of people being displaced, although we, as I said, we really don't know totally. But what about the role of the United Nations in all this, Graham Wood?
The United Nations has been largely absent from Iraq for not just during this conflict, but for well over a decade before that. I mean, in 2003, once the United Nations headquarters was bombed in Baghdad, that you've seen a steady diminishment in the power of the United Nations to do much at all. So the United Nations simply doesn't have much of a role in it, and it would be tough for them to step up.
What about the role of Iran while we have time left here? I mean, it's certainly been central and significant in terms of winning back Mosul for Iraq, but there's always been this attempt by the Iraqi government to separate themselves from Tehran, and yet in many respects it's getting harder to separate, isn't it?
Yeah, if you're looking at the situation objectively, you have to see the Iranian hand all over this. Iran has been able to have its controlled militias as front and center in the fight against ISIS and essentially taking over parts of Sunni territory of Iraq, which looks terrible to Sunnis and good to Iran.
Graham Wood, thank you so much for, as usual, your expert analysis. Appreciate very much having had you with us here on Forum this morning.
Thank you, Michael.
And again, Graham Wood's book is The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. He's correspondent for The Atlantic. We're coming up on another segment here. We're going to talk locally about some pretty shocking numbers. Numbers are shocking enough in Mosul, but closer to home here, 80% of the firefighters who warned about places that needed to be flagged in Oakland, no follow-up. We'll hear more about that. That's all coming up on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.